This morning, we're going to start a new book, and that will be the book of Proverbs. And Proverbs is a very unique book, and in order to ease ourselves into it, we have to do a little background work, because Proverbs is what's called wisdom literature in the Old Testament. And I'd like to do a little introduction to what wisdom literature is this hour, and then next hour I'll do an introduction to the book of Proverbs itself, because the wisdom books all concentrate on a different problem. And the wisdom books, by way of subject matter, deal with a very important problem and one that we have to answer. A lot of people try to pass this off and not face the fact, but you know what? The world we live in is not a just world. And how many times have you had somebody say to you, how could a loving God allow, you fill in the blank? That's why I don't believe in God, because a loving God would never allow post-nasal drip in his plan of creation. But this problem, not the problem of post-nasal drip, but the problem of the injustice of the world we live in, it's addressed in these wisdom books. And we're going to learn the answers to the very tough questions that people ask. So this is a very important study, and I want to point out right away that Proverbs is not a dispensational book. It's not written simply to the Old Testament dispensation. Proverbs is a book of object lessons that are true always. So we're not saying this is how things were, things are different now when we study Proverbs. It's very much applicable to today. And in fact, we'll see as we go through these problems, they're the questions that we face day in and day out as believers. Now, the injustice problem is dealt with mainly in the books of Job and Ecclesiastes. Those deal with the injustice. They deal with the question of how do we explain the suffering of the righteous and the apparent prosperity of the wicked. And you'll have to admit, if you look around, you see that. You see righteous people suffering. You see wicked people prospering. And you say, well, what's God thinking? How could he do that? And that is addressed in Psalm 73. If you were here when we studied Psalm 73, that addresses that problem as well. So I want to explain that the wisdom literature in the Old Testament is a theme that runs throughout the Old Testament, but the wisdom books themselves are Job, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs. Those are the wisdom books, but that theme is throughout the Old Testament. You find the thread of that theme. How do we explain that? How do you explain the events of 9/11? How could a loving God allow that to happen? The book of Proverbs deals with another problem, and that is, how do we live a skillful life? And the book of Proverbs is based on an observation. And that observation is, if you look around, you see most people just bumbling through life. They don't have a clue where they came from or where they're going. They're just bumbling around. Proverbs is going to tell us how we can live a skillful life. Think of your life. Can you label your life as skillfully lived? In all areas. I'm not just talking about doctrine here. All areas. Everything you do in your life can be done skillfully. And even if you can't describe your life as a skillful life, don't be discouraged, because Proverbs is going to show us how we can. So no matter where you're at, you can learn from this. It can be corrected. One of the benefits of Proverbs, one of the big benefits is you can learn to lead a skillful life while you're still young. So Proverbs is very applicable to young people. Have you ever wondered? Sometimes I wonder why the most critical decisions you make in life have to be made at the time when you're least able to make critical decisions. For example, how many 18 to 20-year-old people do you know who are skilled at selecting a mate? And yet that's normally when we get married. We have to make that choice, and we're not prepared. Well, Proverbs says you can prepare young people to make a wise choice. You know, as we get older, we gain experience. We look around, we see things, and our choices become easier to make based on all that experience that we've had. I've had lots of experience. But we don't have to depend on experience to know how to lead a skillful life. The book of Proverbs, it should be the handbook for every young person. This is going to tell you how to lead a life that's skillful. And wisdom and skill, we'll get to that when we get to the details, but they're the same thing. The word wisdom in Hebrew, chokhmah, is a word that basically means skill. So the wisdom literature tells us how to live skillful lives. So just in summary, we can say this. The wisdom books in the Bible tell us how to live a skillful life. That's Proverbs. And it tells us why even if we're living a skillful life, we still encounter suffering. That's Job. He encountered suffering, and he was living a skillful life. And it tells us what value we're to place on the temporal things in life. That's the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you think of the wisdom books, those are the three subjects that they address. And they'll answer the difficult questions. We'll notice a change in the tone from the books that we've studied so far in the Old Testament, like Genesis, Exodus. You know, the wisdom books, the tone of the writers is different from those books, except for parts of Psalms, as I mentioned before. But the parts of the Old Testament we've studied so far, by and large, you have very blunt, you will do this. Exodus. What's Exodus? The law. You will do this, you won't do that. Very blunt, very straightforward. The prophets, what's their exhortation? Thus says the Lord. It's a matter of urgency. Hurry up. Proverbs is going to tell us, slow down. Think about it. It's a little bit different than what we're used to. And the wisdom sections, and again, wisdom is a theme throughout the Old Testament, but it's these three books that are characteristic of it. They're going to tell us to think hard, think humbly, keep your eyes open, use your common sense. Wow, there's a new concept in Christian living, isn't it? Use your common sense. And don't avoid even the most disturbing questions. A lot of Christians try to push those back out of their mind, you know. The people ask them a tough question, they'll try to push it back. Well, I just believe that. Think about those. We have answers. And we're going to learn those answers. I'm kind of excited about this, as you may be able to tell. The wisdom books of the Bible, I'll just summarize Job and Ecclesiastes, and then we'll study Proverbs, and I'll introduce that next hour. But the wisdom books of the Bible, Job, Ecclesiastes, and Proverbs, the book of Job tells us, why do the righteous suffer? Look at Job chapter 1. Job is right before Psalms, so it's easy to find. Job. Somebody called here one time and wanted the Job tapes. I don't know if he just thought that's how it was pronounced or if he thought they were tapes telling him how to get a job. But a godly man, Job, is going to suffer. An evil man are going to prosper in this book. And the book's going to tell us why. And it's something that may not be easy to hear. Why do the righteous suffer? One very important point to notice is that Job teaches us clearly that suffering is no indication on the blame of the sufferer. I mean, it's not his fault, and we'll see in this book. It's not Job's fault that he suffers. And we misunderstand that sometimes as Christians. In fact, I have a long history of health problems, and I was told one time about my stomach problems that I'd better, you know, check on my relationship with God because he's probably punishing me for one thing or another. Now, the guy that told me that, after he got up off the floor, he... I'm kidding. I didn't really slug him. I just felt like it. But that's a false conclusion. Job had absolutely nothing to do with his suffering. It wasn't his fault. Look at John chapter 9. We find the same thing in the New Testament. And in John chapter 9, verses 1 to 3, talking about the blind man. It says, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And what did the disciples ask him? And they had this conception too, that if there's suffering, somebody must have done something wrong to deserve it. So the disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? And notice Jesus answered. He said, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was so the works of God might be displayed in him. So this man suffered so that the works of God could be displayed in him when Jesus healed him. Same thing with Job. Job's going to be a little different circumstance, but it's not his fault that he's suffering. But the point of Job that really gets to me anyway is that he died without ever having the faintest idea why he suffered so much. He never knew. God never told him. Compare that to modern Christianity or churchianity, evangelistic, whatever. We are absolutely obsessed with the idea of knowing God's purpose for our life, aren't we? I mean, we pray about where we should live, what we should wear, how we should comb our hair, what kind of car to drive, what to have for dinner. Should we have beans or peas? Let's pray about it. You know, we want to know every detail of God's plan for our lives. But here Job lived his entire life and he suffered like we probably will never suffer. And he never knew why. Never once did God tell him, Job, I'm proving something with you. You have an incredible privilege. God never told him that. He knew it, but God didn't tell him. You know, it's an insult to God to put conditions on your service to him, in my opinion. You say, God, okay, I'll serve you, but you have to tell me how, when, where, and why. God doesn't give us those details. We have to figure them out. We serve God all the time, everywhere, for any reason. We don't put limitations on our service to God, or we're not supposed to. We do. Job's life fulfilled a purpose that most of us will never achieve. And yet he didn't know it. His whole entire life, he never knew it. And you see, the first two chapters of Job, you have two viewpoints. You have a heavenly viewpoint and an earthly viewpoint. And Job is down here living on earth, and God is in heaven talking to Satan. Job doesn't know what they're talking about. God doesn't tell him. In fact, that would have ruined everything if you stop and think about it. God is being insulted by Satan in heaven. Meanwhile, down on earth, there's Job. He's living prosperously. He's obeying God, loving the Lord. Look at Job 1 and verse 1. It says, there was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, turning away from evil. He's living a skillful life, in other words. Seven sons and three daughters, very prosperous. His possessions also, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camel, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. So, incredibly successful man. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. What a perfect family. He had the perfect family, and he was always concerned about their spiritual well-being. He sacrificed for them. So that's Job. He loved God. He was doing everything right, living an incredibly prosperous life. And meanwhile, in heaven, Satan is insulting God. In Job 1, 9 through 11, we have the challenge. Job 1, 9 says, then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. So what's the implication that Satan's making here? The implication is simple. Nobody loves God for who God is. Job only loves God because God has made him prosper. He's given him all these things. Well, sure, anybody'd love a God who gave him all that. That's what Satan is saying to God. So, what happens? God responds. Satan saying nobody loves God just because he's God. They love God because of what? The prosperity that he brings them. And God responds by removing the barriers that he set about Job. He says, okay, I'll show you. This guy loves me for who I am. I'm going to take away some of the barriers. He's still in control. God is in absolute control at all times. He doesn't give up his control. What he does is say, okay, Satan, I'm going to give you some authority to do bad things to Job. Now look at Job 1:13. And here we have, now on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, perfect family life, you know, they're just having a nice meal, sitting down, eating a little wine, drinking a little cheese, or drinking a little wine, eating a little cheese. You know, I have trouble with that because I have trouble remembering that I'm supposed to drink water and breathe air. I get those two confused all the time, and I spend a lot of time choking and coughing because of it. I have a drinking problem. I inhale water instead of swallowing, and then it makes it hard to breathe. Anyway, here they are, drinking a little wine, eating a little cheese, taking in some rays, you know, just having a good time. And all of a sudden, a messenger shows up. And the messenger, in verse 14, says, the messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died. I alone survived to come and tell you. So Job lost everything in one swell foop, as we say. Everything's gone. Was it his fault? No, that God and Satan in heaven, you know, Satan was insulting God, and God says, you know what, this Job, I know him, he loves me for who I am. So you go ahead and take away all his prosperity, and you see if he still doesn't love me. And that's exactly what he did. And remember, Job had no idea that this was happening in heaven. So one catastrophe follows another. Look at verse 20. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshiped. He worshiped God. Even though he'd lost everything. Most people would curse God because he'd lost everything. Job did not. He worshiped God. So God was right, Satan was wrong. And Job had the incredible privilege to prove that. But he didn't know it. He just knew that he loved God. Job failed to curse God. Verse 21, it says, he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Even after all of that. So Job proved what God was saying. Now in chapter 2, Satan ups the ante. Okay, he says, I've taken away Job's prosperity, but I haven't really hurt him at all. You haven't let me do that, he says to God. God says, okay, and again, he gives him limited authority. You can hurt him, but you can't kill him. So what happens in the following context? You've heard about Job, you've read Job. He suffered boils, he suffered sickness, he suffered all kinds of personal maladies. And he still didn't know why he's suffering, but he suffered all of these things. And throughout this whole book, Job has the privilege of showing that he loves God for who God is, not for what he gives him materially. The answer to the problem of the book of Job is what? Why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? The answer is very easy. They suffer for the glory of God. And that's what Job was suffering for, the glory of God. Even though how was not revealed to him. So if you have to suffer, if you're going through suffering, if you're going through persecution, anything, you know what? You don't have to know why. God doesn't have to tell you that. All you have to know is that God is sovereign. God is in control. He loves you. He knows what he's doing. So shut up and believe him. And that's what Job did. Great book, isn't it? We'll study that sometime. I considered going to Job because of all the things that are happening in the world today. But how can God let all this stuff happen? Israel is losing all her allies in the Middle East. I was reading an article by a conservative the other day, and he said that we have to give up on Israel. We have to let them go because they're costing us lives in Iraq, our allegiance to them. So the military is saying, and this was a general that was saying to the president, that if you don't dump Israel, so to speak, then you're costing American lives. Never mind, Israel is the only even remotely democratic country in the Middle East. All the rest are dictators. Never mind that. We should dump them for our own well-being. Well, you know what? What's God going to think about that? So we may see some of this Job stuff coming up. We'll pass that now. What about Ecclesiastes? Ecclesiastes answers a really tough question. What's the point of living? And the philosophers have a heyday with this one. And the writer of Ecclesiastes is going to say, going to try every possible thing that he can to find meaning and happiness through his senses. Every possible thing. And the preacher, the one writing in Ecclesiastes 1:1, is Solomon. And he had a very special position because he was one of the few people who have ever lived that had the resources to try anything he wanted to. He could try anything. He was rich. He was powerful. He could do anything he wanted. Think about it, guys, and don't go all Holy Joe on me here. He could have any woman he wanted. In fact, he tried 900 of them. 600 wives and 300 concubines. He had the resources to indulge every fleshly desire you can possibly imagine. Now, don't get the wrong idea. In Ecclesiastes, it says the words of the preacher, and we put a minister context on that word. That's not what the Hebrew word means. A preacher is just somebody that has something to say. That's all it means. It's not a religious word like we have the connotation in English. So he had something to say. Never saw a woman he couldn't have, a thing he couldn't buy, or an experience he couldn't try. I mean, he was very wealthy, very powerful. Now, the key idea of the book of Ecclesiastes is that Solomon, after he tried everything possible to find meaning and happiness through the senses, came to the conclusion that everything is vanity. Look at verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities. All is vanity. That's where he came to after trying every possible thing he could try. And the word vanity is hevel in Hebrew, and what it means is vapor, mist, emptiness. All life is empty. And think of this from a perspective of an unbeliever. What do they have to find meaning in their life? They make up things, but when it gets right down to it, there is no meaning. life is empty. It's a routine. What do? You get up in the morning, you take a shower, you shave, eat breakfast, get dressed, and you go to work, clock in at 8 o'clock. You work for 8 hours, you clock out, you drive home, eat supper, maybe you get to watch a little TV, and then you sleep. And then what do? You get up, you take a shower, you shave, go to work, clock in, work 8 hours, clock out, drive home, eat supper, watch a little TV, and go to bed. It's all just an endless, meaningless cycle. You know, Henry David Thoreau in the book Walden said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. That's what he concluded. Clarence Darrow, you remember Clarence Darrow, the ACLU lawyer? He was an atheist, a staunch atheist. In fact, he took the Scopes trial, you know, the monkey trials in 1925. He said that was the only trial he ever did pro bono. That means he didn't get paid for it. And the only reason he took it was so he could disgrace William Jennings Bryan, because Bryan was a believer. That's the only reason he took that case, so he could humiliate Bryant. And he did. He did a pretty good job of it. But Bryant wasn't ready. He wasn't a dumb man. He just wasn't ready. He didn't have his ducks in a row. Very interesting case. You know, Clarence Darrow, in his tirade about the Bible and how stupid it was, says the Bible doesn't agree with science, and he quoted a verse to prove that. The verse wasn't even in the Bible. He made it up while he was talking. Now, if Bryant would have been thinking, he would have got out his Bible and say, wait a minute, what do you mean? I can't find that verse. Because he put Bryant on the witness stand just so he could humiliate him. Actually, Bryant won the case. Scopes was found guilty and fined $100, but everybody thinks that Clarence Darrow came out on top. Anyway, Darrow was an atheist ACLU lawyer, and he said one time that he could summarize his life by Luke 5:5. You don't have to go there. I'll read it for you. What does Luke 5:5 say? Simon answered and said, Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing. That's how he looked at life. He worked hard all his life, and he caught nothing. So you see the despair in these people? And that's what Ecclesiastes answers. It's a difficult book to study because it's very depressing, and you have to wait till the end to get the answer. The author goes on. He probably illustrates it best, better than Clarence Darrow, better than anybody else. What's the point? Now the illustrations. He says a generation comes, or a generation goes, and a generation comes. It's all a cycle, a big endless cycle. And interestingly enough, where this leads is, I have it here somewhere, I was looking for a photograph of a graveyard. And I went to the internet and Googled graveyards, and that's what I came up with. But it's interesting that that photo was in a news article, and the news article was in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and it points out beautifully where that attitude of endless routine, meaningless nothingness ends up. Well, I want to read this article because it's fascinating. Greenpeace. Okay, y'all know who Greenpeace is. They're those wonderful people who are trying to preserve our environment. Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Greenpeace has announced a plan to revamp burial procedures across the modernized world. The called Greenbury was announced today and will be presented to the governments throughout Europe, North and South America, Japan, China, South Korea, as well as to the United Nations. And what does Greenpeace want? They want governments to prohibit burials. and to move towards more natural ways of disposing the deceased. Some of the proposed methods of disposal include shredding, composting. I don't make this up. Who could make this up? The proposal also declares a need to excavate existing grave sites to comply with the new process. So they want to dig up all the dead people and put them in a compost heap. What's the matter? They're dead. You know, there's no meaning anymore. They're just a pile of molecules laying there, rotting in the ground, ruining the soil. Listen, traditional methods of body disposal are severely detrimental to the environment. Chemicals are injected into bodies, which eventually seep into the water table. Harmful metals and other materials from caskets are left to break down and decay, leaching into the soil and causing untold harm to the environment. Boy, I'm terrified. I'm sorry, I can't help but be sarcastic about these people. They're nuts. They're screwballs, and they call us crazy. You know, we're the religious right. We're a bunch of screwballs. They ended up by saying, the people are, after all, dead. What do they care? That's where this ends up. You know, there's no meaning. You're just a pile of compost that happens to be alive at the moment. And when you die, we'll put you in a compost heap so you can help grow crops. Endless cycle. People die, people born. And that's what Ecclesiastes is saying. You know, I tried everything in the world to find meaning, happiness. And all I could find was this endless cycle. I pick up the newspaper, you know, and what do you see? You see births, deaths. You know, I pick up the newspaper before I even get up, and I read the obituaries, and if I'm not in there, I go ahead and get up. That was a joke. I don't even take the paper. That's an old one. Yeah, Linda's heard it before, haven't you? The sun rises, the sun sets. What does it mean? It's going to happen long after you're dead and in a compost pile if Greenpeace has their way. The rivers flow to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. Now, I took this photograph the last time I was at Estes Park in Rocky Mountain National Forest, and it's the Continental Divide. You all know what the Continental Divide is? All the water that falls on the right hand of that sign when you're standing there looking at it ends up in the Pacific Ocean. It goes down through the Colorado River and out the Gulf of California, and it ends up in the Pacific Ocean. But if rain drops 5 feet left of that on the other side of this sign, it ends up in the Atlantic Ocean and goes down through the Platte River to the Missouri, to the Mississippi, to the Gulf down there, and ends up in the Atlantic. So that's the Continental Divide. It's the highest point where the water splits. But what happens to that water? Goes down, makes its way to the ocean. It evaporates from the ocean, turns into clouds, floats back over Milner Pass, rains again, and down it goes again. An endless cycle. It all means nothing. It'll be doing that a million years after you're gone, according to the evolutionists. So the theme of Ecclesiastes is very simple, and it's found in chapter 1, verse 8. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. So the theme is that no matter how many whims or impulses you gratify, you will not find satisfaction in life. As Mick Jagger puts it, I can't get no satisfaction. You just can't. You can't be completely satisfied. Everything is an endless cycle. Our senses are subject to satiety. That's a great word, isn't it? Satiety. It's a good word. Do you know what satiety means? It's a word that means that you get so much, you just can't have any more. Did you ever eat like that? I have. And you eat and eat and eat because something is so good, and pretty soon you're sick. Now, are you satisfied? No, you're sick. You're sated. There's a difference. That's the reason we have that word, satiety. It means that you have so much that you can't have any more, and yet you're still not satisfied. Did you ever hear the old song? I used to sing this song. I don't know if most of you know this, but I used to be kind of a semi-professional folk singer back in the 60s and 70s. And I used to sing this song, and one of the lyrics went, "After you've been eating steak for a long time, beans taste fine. And after you've been drinking champagne and brandy, you're going to want some wine. Because this world that we live in is very strange, and man is a creature of constant change. And after you've been eating steak for a long time, beans taste fine." That's the principle of satiety. You get so much steak, you can't stand it anymore. Are you satisfied? No. But you just had enough. You want to go eat some beans. So there's nothing for the senses that can completely satisfy. And David can probably identify with me. Will you ever have the fastest computer that's going to stay the fastest computer? Never happen. Next week, next month, next year, sometime they're going to make a faster one. And you'll be stuck with an obsolete computer, which is an anathema. So what did Solomon try? He didn't have computers. So he had to try other things. He tried the pursuit of knowledge. Look at 1:12. "I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven." So he tried knowledge, tried pleasure. That's chapter 2. "I said to myself," in verse 1, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself." And behold, it too was futility. He tried philosophy. In 19 and 20 of chapter 2, he says, "And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore, I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun." He became a philosopher. Look at chapter 3, 19 and 20. "For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same." Wow, he joined PETA. You know, man and animal, no difference. Your fate is the same. You're going to end up in a compost pile. He tried wealth in 5:10. All these things, nothing. And it all comes back to chapter 1. Vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. Verse 10 says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity." He tried everything. And he had, you know, this is Solomon we're talking about. He had a vast amount of money, of wealth. It didn't give him any meaning in life. He tried, you could say marriage, but probably sex is a better definition. 600 wives and 300 concubines is what they say. Purely human viewpoint. I don't agree with him on this, but look what he came to as a conclusion in verse 26 of chapter 7. "And I discovered more bitter than death the women whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chained. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her." So he says, I tried 900 times, and I came to the conclusion that women are bad, evil. Now, I don't agree with that, but that was his conclusion. Isn't that attitude prevalent today? Don't like one, try another. We get divorced, we get remarried, we get divorced, we get remarried. I would say, after 900 tries, maybe the problem wasn't with the women, but with him. But the conclusion then is chapter 12. And that's where we finally get to the good news. In chapter 12, verse 1, it tells the answer to the problem of Ecclesiastes. Why is life worth living? With all of this, you know, he tried everything. Nothing made him happy. And 12:1 says, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you will say, I have no delight in them. So he's saying to the young folks, you know, there is no happiness to be found in the senses. There's no meaning to be found in life apart from a relationship to God. That's the only way you'll find meaning. There's no other way. So, Job, what does he say? Why do the righteous suffer? They suffer to glorify God, even if you don't know why. Ecclesiastes, what makes life worth living? A relationship with God, nothing else. Now, Proverbs is going to tell us how to live a skillful life. And we'll look at that next hour. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the wisdom books. We pray that we can be diligent in our studies so that we can live skillful lives as Christians. In Christ's name, amen.